We're talking this afternoon with Jason Turbeau, one of the authors of the new and popular Baseball Codes, Beanball Sign Stealing and Bench Clearing Brawls, the Unwritten Rules of America's Pastime. And we're happy that Jason has a chance to spend a few minutes with us today. Hey, Jason.
Hello, Ron. How are you?
Good, thank you. Well, congratulations on the book.
Thank you.
And the first thing I want to establish, between Dallas Braden and Alex Rodriguez and the Phillies using binoculars to steal signs, I want you to admit it right now that these are Confederates paid by your publisher to get some press for the book.
Oh, no, absolutely not. I will never admit it. I pay them directly. My publisher has nothing to do with it. So, those guys could not have done better things to help my business.
You can't buy this kind of publicity. This is amazing.
No, I wish I could buy it, Rod. Clearly it takes a few levels above my pay scale to get that done. But he's working for free for me. It's awesome publicity. People have been turning my way far more frequently than I ever imagined they would. It's been doing wonders for the book.
Now let's look at Braden and Rodriguez for a while. Braden is a relatively new guy. Rodriguez has been around for a long time. Braden knew the unwritten rule about the batter doesn't step on the pitcher's territory, and Rodriguez claims he didn't. If you believe that, why do you think that's so?
I believe that Rodriguez didn't know it was a quote-unquote unwritten rule. What I don't believe is that Rodriguez didn't do it on purpose, as he claimed. From where he was standing on the base path, the first base, the straight line didn't take him anywhere near the mound. He took his own little route to go over that mound for whatever his reasons were. And he probably didn't know it was an unwritten rule because people don't talk about it. In the aftermath.
Even my 16-year-old daughter knows. I mean, she's manager of her high school baseball team. Even she knows that you don't walk from third to first, stuck in a straight line through the pitcher's mound.
Yeah, it's exactly right. Which is why it was actually a bit surprising to me to hear, all these baseball insiders, guys who had played the game and managed in the game, afterward saying they'd never heard of it either. Granted, there's a large number who have heard of it, and, in the course of researching my book, I talked to, a lot of people who expounded on that very topic. I guess people don't talk about it because it just doesn't happen that frequently. Guys, just inherent. You don't go across the pitcher's mound unless you really want to. There's just no reason to be there, even geographically. There's very few spots in the diamond that force you to cross the pitcher's mound to get from one spot to the other in a straight line. And there's a couple guys, A.J. Pierzynski most notably, who go out of their way to do it. I think A.J. is, a devious cat. He has ulterior motives and wants to rattle pitchers, and that's fine. That's his prerogative. He's certainly been drilled for it. And he knows the price he'll pay for doing things like that. He does it anyway.
Well, this is for the gamesmanship.
Yeah, exactly. As far as A-Rod goes, who knows what he was thinking? Who knows what he's ever thinking?
I'm sorry. With A-Rod, this isn't the first time he's engaged in such shenanigans. I mean, he tried to swat the ball out of Arroyo's hands running down to first base, and he yelled at a third baseman trying to catch a foul pop.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was Howie Clark with Toronto. He has this kind of ongoing series of odd baseball decisions, doing things that, might not even technically be called unwritten rules, just because who does that kind of stuff? There's no unwritten rule that says, well, don't swat a baseball out of a guy's glove, just because it's not something anyone would ever consider doing. And there's not an unwritten rule that says don't yell behind a fielder camped under a pop-up, because outside of Little League, who does that?
I was just going to say, even in Little League, they teach you sportsmanship in Little League. But in one of your chapters, you name one of your chapters, if you're not cheating, you're not trying. At what point does sportsmanship disappear? Is it once you become a professional and then, as you write, you do what you can to put food on the table for your family?
Well, gamesmanship is an interesting topic, and I think it falls under the same category as almost the entire rest of the code book, and that's respect. The unwritten rules are about respecting your team, respecting your opponents, and respecting the game. And a lot of, you know, the quote-unquote cheating that goes on a baseball diamond is tolerated because it's not seen as an affront in that respect. You know, Alex Rodriguez yelling behind an infielder definitely is seen as an affront in that respect, and crossing a mound, undoubtedly. But, you know, a pitcher loading up a baseball is trying to get an edge, and the hitter doesn't see that as disrespectful. He sees it as someone trying to get ahead, and the unwritten rule in this case is if you're caught, you stop. It's the same with sign stealing. You know, you don't hear many people making a big stink about teams stealing their signs, even though it happens all the time, because once you're caught, you stop. It's an accepted part of the game.
Well, that was the name of another book. If you ain't cheating, you don't get caught. I'm sorry, I forget the name of it. But if you don't get caught, you can still cheat regardless. Do you think this is a generational thing? You're talking about some guys not knowing some of these unwritten rules, but yet in your book, when you go back to some of the older players, they don't, well, for example, you write about how often players change teams now. And that there isn't that kind of intense rivalry, traditional rivalry. Is there any ill feelings between the teams because of something recent that's happened? So do you think there's some sort of generational thing where younger players don't have the kind of respect for the game that their forebears had?
Well, yeah, I think that's definitely the case. You know, it might not be to as great a degree as one might fear. You know, young players are rushed to the big leagues much more quickly than they ever have been, giving them, you know, a much steeper learning curve as far as the unwritten rules go. So, you know, a surprisingly high number of them actually reach the big leagues without really knowing proper propriety and how to engender respect on the field. And you know, those are lessons that they're taught at the big league level, hopefully by one of their teammates, you know, and if they're unfortunate, it's taught to them by one of their opponents. You know, at the same time, when you introduce money to the degree that, you know, all sports have in recent generations, in the last decade, two decades, you're going to have more players playing for the love of the paycheck than playing for the love of the game. And those are the guys who care less about the history and things like the unwritten rules than in years past. And, you know, to your earlier point, when you've got guys jumping from team to team every couple of years, you got them taking vacations together in the off-season. They share agents. They play in golf tournaments. You know, they're guys with friends literally in every clubhouse. And these codes were kind of developed as a means of keeping opposing teams who were by design, you know, very antagonistic of each other. It was a means of keeping them civil. And when you've got friendships across the field, there's less need for a code to enact civility because it's there inherently. So there's a whole bunch of reasons that go into this.
Is there even any rule in the book anymore about anti-fraternizing?
Yeah, it's there. It's there, but, it's rarely enforced.
Wink, wink.
You know, a few years ago, you know, one of the Giants told a member of the opposing team to get the hell out of the team stretch after he plopped down and started chatting with someone. But that was, you know, that's a rare thing. You know, just last season, I think, I remember seeing Pedro Feliz in his Phillies uniform in the Giants clubhouse. Because, you know, he was a member of the Giants. He still has a lot of friends on the team. No one there seemed to mind. And it just hit me, especially, you know, having talked to a lot of guys about what they would do. And by guys, I mean old-timers. What they would do if they saw that, they're like, I wouldn't do anything because I wouldn't see it. It didn't happen. You know, these days, it happens occasionally, and it's tolerated more than ever, for sure.
How many players did you interview for this book?
Probably close to 250.
And as a longtime follower of the game, what was there something here that really stood out that really surprised you?
I don't want to say surprised, but, you know, looking back in retrospect at how the interview process went, it became very clear how much this code meant to the old-timers. You know, and I kind of divided the interview process up into two parts. The first part was talking to the old-timers, consisting of managers, coaches, broadcasters, scouts, whoever's around a ballpark who once played the game. And they opened up to a degree that I never thought they would. And it was only after the process that I could look back and say, well, that was because this code meant something to them. This is the way they were brought up in baseball. This is the way they played baseball. And they could see it kind of fraying at the edges, like you say, you know, fraternization is acceptable now. You know, a guy pimping his home run for a little bit is more acceptable now than he used to be. And talking to me about this is possibly one way that they could kind of keep the code around a little bit. You know, modern players don't want to talk as much, you know, partly because you know, they're held accountable with fastballs from opponents, whereas ex-players are not. You know, and modern players can talk to a degree, but seeing the old timers really, really kind of dig into this topic was very impressive.
Now, you mentioned the difference between old timers and new timers, the generational divide. Is there an international divide? Like, Japan has a history of being very respectful for the game. When a pitcher hits an opposing batter, I don't know if they still do, they used to bow to them as a form of apology. Is there an international component to this?
There is. You know, it was definitely something we pursued. The Japanese code is strict, but it's different than the American code. You know, the Japanese methods of exhibiting respect are very, very different than in big league ball. You know, Japanese game is not really a game of contact. Taking out fielders is not something they do frequently. They have their own ways of dealing with American players there. So Japanese players coming to this country do have a steep learning curve because they've learned how to play, you know, baseball functionally, but they haven't learned how to play it morally according to the American code. So, you know, I remember a few years ago, Tsuyoshi Shinjo came over with the Mets, and he was swinging at 3-0 pitches in blowout games and subsequently getting drilled just because he had no idea. I mean, he wasn't being disrespectful. He had never learned that code. There's some of that going on. I think you know, the same is true with Latin American ball players, who, you know, you look at the games in Central South America, they're a very emotional affair. Especially when you talk to American players who go down in the winter, they're like, "Oh my God, I've never seen such passion." But when they bring that mindset to the big leagues, and you know, they're pumping their fist on the mound, well, it doesn't fly so much. And it's, you know, it's lessons everybody has to learn, and eventually they do.
I want to turn it for a minute to the creative side of the book. You wrote this book with Michael Duca. What was the division of labor there?
Well, Michael gets the credit for coming up with the idea. I ran a Giants page in the San Francisco Chronicle for a number of years. He was one of my writers. And when he told me he'd been sitting on this idea for a book on the unwritten rules, you know, it was like, you know, the flashbulbs went off in my head, of course. Like, why didn't anyone do this before? And so we sat down. We pretty much divided the interview process down the middle. You know, we grabbed as many players as we could, as frequently as we could. It was just, you know, catch as catch can. When we were able to, we did the interviews together. And, you know, when I was traveling, I would stop in ballparks all over and talk to people. And he would do the same. And then I'm the one who sat down and wrote the book. So, you know, he gave his input on how things should go, but you know, the writing was mine and the idea was his, and I think we're all pretty happy with the results.
Okay, and your publisher is Pantheon. Is this your first book?
It is.
So you don't really have a basis of comparison, but do you find that as an author, a lot of the burden of publicizing the book falls on you? I see you have a website for the book. Do you have to arrange for your own speaking engagements, or do they help you out with that?
They do help. There is a lot that's left to me and to Michael. You know, I've been doing the website entirely on my own. They're delighted that I'm doing it, you know, and they've done a little bit to kind of help out with support for it, but, you know, it's a labor of love. Mm-hmm. You know, they've set up some engagements, they've set up some good radio spots, but a lot of it has been on us to set up what we can. You know, I'm doing some traveling in the Midwest and the East Coast later this summer, and, you know, based on that, they're helping set up some speaking events, some media and things like that. But you know, a lot of it is self-generated.
Now that seems to be the way it is nowadays. I don't know if that's a result of the recession hitting the business in general or just the way things are progressing as a natural event.
Well, you know, my guess is, and I don't know if this is actually the case, you know, I've got a publicist at Random House who, you know, by all measures seems overwhelmed, because I'm sure she has, you know, many more duties than she once did, because they probably have far less staff than they once did. So, you know, there's only so much attention anybody can devote to any one project.
So you're enjoying the ride at the moment?
Absolutely. Well, I get to talk to people like you. It's fun. You know, I've never talked so much baseball in my life.
That there's always there should be no reason to be able to talk baseball. So we're glad you had the opportunity to chat with us again. We've been talking with Jason Turbo, author of The Baseball Codes. Thank you very much, Jason.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.